That's in the air, this could be out. Jarvan's underneath it, will he catch it? He's got good hands, he's got him, yes he has. Jarvan's got him in the deep. Having fumbled all night, he's taken the big one. It went miles in the air, he's got it out. Miles, a good catch.
Couch Talk.
Hello and welcome to Couch Talk. The guest today is former Australian opening batsman Matthew Hayden. He talks in detail about his pre-match visualization routines, his very successful partnership with Justin Langer, and how he learned to be a better player of spin bowling, amongst other things. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Yeah, thanks, Bash. Thanks, mate.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure having you on. You were known for your visualization routines on the eve of a test match, where you would sit on the pitch at one end and visualize facing the opposition bowlers. You know, I want to learn more about it. First off, you know, when did it become part of your preparation routine, and who was instrumental in your adopting it?
Yeah, well, it was something which has been with me pretty much my whole career, in particular my professional career. My brother, who was my coach, 5 years my elder, Gary, he studied human movement studies at Queensland University here in Brisbane. And we used to train together pretty much every day, and we'd train so long that by the end of the particular training session, we'd physically almost collapse down on the ground, and oftentimes being in the nets, the closest and most peaceful environment, certainly the greenest environment, was the centre strip of any ground around Brisbane. So we'd virtually just collapse down in a heap and go through, I guess, talk through a little bit about, you know, what we'd learnt in the session, so a bit of a debrief on the session, and then a briefing on, you know, what we're looking to do in the next session, which would be inevitably the next day or the next morning. Mm-hmm. And so it really started from there when Gary no longer toured with me. That process of gathering my thoughts, sitting down in an environment which was very comfortable to me, and going through the kind of expectations that I was had in store for me over, you know, the week's period of the test match or the one day or so forth, getting used to the conditions, understanding, you know, where breezes were coming from, you know, what sighting and the background of bowlers' arms were going to look like, eliminating all of those details really that, you know, were such a critical element of the process of batting, so that there was no surprises on the day. And really just going through how I felt at the time, and there was various confronting emotional things that I needed to deal with, whether that be, you know, touring in a country like India, just, you know, understanding, you know, what the environment was presenting to me and how I was managing that internally. You know, so it's an hour conversation really, because there were so many things that would go through my mind in such a short period of time. But then ultimately in the middle, I would just let it all go. I'd be completely relaxed. I'd be looking down at the wicket, loving the environment of being outside and being in a physical state of mind where I was so at peace with my conditions. So, look, it was a wonderful time of my life. I must admit it's probably one of the things that I miss the most about batting and in particular playing cricket is that meditation of cricket, that involvement of myself, mind, body and spirit into delivering on one specific process, and that's to execute a cricket shot. You know, it's a beautiful feeling. It's a feeling which is very hard to replicate, and just, you know, as a civilian, you know, not playing sport, to get that sense of real belonging and feeling, you know, how you're progressing through the day was something I really love and do miss.
When you do that, you know, you talked about the background and the breeze and the general construction, the ambience and the atmospherics of the place, so on and so forth. At the same time, are you also visualizing the opposition bowlers and, you know, and trying to identify areas of, you know, scoring perhaps easily or, you know, a get out shot or something like that? Are you visualizing the actual process of, you know, ball being delivered and like a golfer would, you know, hitting a shot?
Of course. Yeah, of course. But it's like, for example, I might be sitting on the wicket now and I can see Zahir Khan coming into bowl around the wicket and first ball him trying to deviate through a swinging delivery with the new ball and have me trapped in front. You know, so you know, visualizing what that looks like, seeing how I'm going to process that in my head before the event actually happens. So again, there was no surprises, or it might be that he was trying to bowl, you know, a slower bouncer with two people back, or, you know, just working through the scenarios and understanding how it is that I was going to win on each one of those occasions, and how I was going to, you know, master, I guess, and control my own destiny with him one delivery. And I would go through that, and look, I might be there for, you know, 10 minutes and feel really confident that I just need to see no more, or I might be there for 2 hours. In fact, it was always pretty much a tradition where everyone would go to the ground and have throwdowns or nets the day before the game. Mm-hmm. My net session was completed in my head, just by sitting down and going through those various scenarios. It might be a Kirtley Ambrose or Courtney Walsh, you know, coming across the left-hander from around the wicket and understanding, you know, the batting zones where I could feel comfortable leaving the ball, you know, lining up the stumps and almost visualising like Hawkeye does now with its kind of corridor. That would be something I could see in my mind before that even technology came in. So it was very interesting times.
So let me, is that, you know, for example, when you are in a purple patch where, you know, and your mind is free of any thoughts, you're just reacting to the ball. So, you know, cricket happens quite naturally, instinctively. And there are times when you go through rough patches. So I just want to compare those two things. And on a day before a test match where you're slightly under pressure because the runs are not coming, or, you know, you are just scoring by the bucket loads, how is that, the visualization approach is changing from one to the other?
Well, firstly, there's always pressure, whether you're in top-notch nick or not, to perform is the game of cricket. Whether you like it or not, you have to give away to the fact that it is very much a ball-by-ball event. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of my best innings, in fact, have been innings that have less than 50 balls in duration because of the conditions, for example. And you won't get the glory of a 50, 100, 150, 200, but you will get the inner peace of knowing that you committed to what your process was on the day, and that you're a part of that process and living out that process. But it's a good form and bad form is a little bit like driving a vehicle. Mm. When you're in good form, you drive from A to B, and it might be 2 hours in duration, and it feels like 2 minutes because you're in the flow, you've got your stereo pumped up, you're comfortable with your seating arrangements and the climate within the car, you've got good banter in the car if you've got some travelling guests, etc. Mm-hmm. You're just in a feeling of flow. Bad form is like that same trip, but you're now being tailgated by a police officer. and everything that was very unconscious, where time was just flowing and there was no thought process involved in any particular other than just driving, you suddenly then become aware of pretty much everything in your conscience. In other words, am I too close to fellow drivers? Am I indicating correctly? Is my speed limit correct? You know, it's all of those thought processes, which if you were to relate to batting, it is, am I watching the ball? Is my body position excellent? Am I moving according to the conditions? Have I got the right strategy for playing certain deliveries? All those things become very, very conscious. And it's in that sort of meticulous detail and that clunkiness or awkwardness around being tailgated by a police officer that, when you're not in the flow, all of those things become a lot more relevant to your case. And inevitably, you know, you get out in that process. You're stuck in a mindset of almost analysis paralysis, if you like.
Yeah, I see. Let me, you know, you played more than 100 tests and scored runs everywhere. So let me just give you a couple of examples of, and you could tell me, or let us learn from what you may have done in those actual scenarios. You know, for example, one, let's say you're playing against Muralidharan, you know, playing against Sri Lanka. You know, your main goal is to combat Murali, but you still have to get past the seamers first as an opening batsman. And the second scenario is, you know, you probably on a fast, you know, maybe like a pitch at GABA or WACA or Kingsmead, you're playing against South Africa, you know, where it's going to be a very similar-oriented attack. So how is your preparation changing in these two scenarios?
Yeah, there is significant difference, albeit subtle, because the basis behind batting, no matter where you are, whether or what level I might add, whether it's, you know, backyard cricket, club cricket, you know, first class cricket, international cricket, your mind doesn't really know any different, other than it's got ultimate control over its various stages of processing. So what I mean by that is that, for example, I could face a seam attack like South Africa, and the wicket conditions like they were one time in Melbourne for the Boxing Day Test match were very damp. It had been a drought in Melbourne, but the conditions almost miraculously were ones where the play was delayed and Australia lost the toss and we were sent into bat on a very green wicket. And so any preparation that you would have thought leading up into that test match is pretty much out the door, because you've now got to commit to a lot of different processes, which are watching the ball, good body movement, good body language, you know, great strategy. So, you know, in those conditions, I wasn't interested in how many runs I got in the first session, maybe even the second session. I was just prepared to weather the storm, bat time, and pick off any mistakes which were to come my way. So, you know, there's too much to plan for on any one given sort of one strategy. And so you have to change accordingly. And it's in change where I think athletes, you know, they master their environment. You know, if you're working now in a business environment like I am, it's very hard to get human resource to change its thinking. It does what it does well. It loves its structure. It locks into a structure and tries to deliver on that structure. But in a sporting environment, you know, you might have one, as I've just mentioned, you might have one structure which needs to completely change overnight, and yet you're the same person. And it's the same when you travel to a place like Sri Lanka and Murali Duram is running in and bowling and he's playing on the opposite conditions to what you've grown up on as a kid.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly now having to alter everything that you have thought about within the space of a short period of time to get the police officer out of the back of your rear vision mirror and for you just to be on drive process and then ultimately for you to be the police officer. So the hunter becomes the hunter.
Yeah.
And that was very much in my overall kind of psychology of trying to execute, you know, a certain base process of batting so that I was on the front foot rather than being, you know, on that back foot and reacting to conditions.
All right. I want to switch gears and talk a bit about your batting partnership with Justin Langer. You know, initially you had some partnerships with Michael Slater, Mark Taylor, etc. And it was the last test of 2001 Ashes when you began that partnership. Phenomenal partnership. And you had written in your book about JL, and I quote, "We were united in our passion by our work ethic, but diametrically opposed in other areas." Could you expand on the similarities and where you were different?
Yeah, certainly. You know, where we were different is that, well, for a start, he's vertically challenged. No, I'm just joking. He was a very different batsman to me. So technically, even though we grew up in extremely similar circumstances, being those of fast, bouncy wickets in the Gabba and the Wacker, how we handled those was polar opposite. So he was very much, you know, let the ball come onto the bat and would hit very well through cover point, third man. Whereas I was much more up at the ball and was very opposite in terms of what coaching dynamics were as we were youth cricketers growing up, which was to come back and across at the ball. I always challenged that thinking because of my height to come forward and across to the ball, which is kind of, I think, more of a power position. as opposed to letting and reacting off the wicket. Neither are incorrect in their approach. Both have their place, but that's pointing out the differences in our technique. So whenever anyone was saying, you know, lefties can't come together, I was always disagreeing with that because, you know, if you look at a Gilchrist and Hayden, our scoring zones are almost the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Langer and Hayden, our scoring zones, again, are exact opposite. Sure, we can play all the shots, and on any given day, if you bat long enough, you're going to have a wagon wheel that looks like it has got silk threads all over the 360 degrees. But the predominant areas of our scoring are opposite. He was, as I mentioned before, down to sort of third man around to cover point and covers, and I was mid-off around the other side of the ground. So it gave us a natural synergy from a batting technical point of view, but it wasn't really the glue to our relationship. The glue was without any question the ingredients around values and our cultural elements, our love of the game, our work ethic and our commitment to actually get to the baggy green side was one of many years of forged through very hard work and lots of performance.
Mm-hmm.
And also just challenging the culture in terms of fitness and being, you know, really... really in an environment where we wanted to be the absolute best professionals we could be as well, which came through that commitment to hard work. You know, and even spiritually as well, we had a great love of the outdoors and food and our families and relation. We put enormous emphasis on relationships and celebration of key milestones. And, you know, there was so much to the relationship, Shabazz, that was almost the perfect storm in terms of a competitive combination of two individuals.
That's fantastic. You know, for a long time, the theory was that, you know, the openers, they would see off a new ball and allow the middle order to flourish, set the platform for them. I mean, the Aussie teams that you were part of, you and Jale were part of, I mean, phenomenal batsmen all the way through. But you and Jale were equally aggressive as the middle order, if not more. Was there a specific moment in time where there was a change in philosophy, or was it something that you grew up with in Shield cricket and then you just brought it to the international game?
Yeah, it's a really interesting perception, and I say that because perception is reality. and it's one where... both of us, I think, as we started our youth cricket, were very much in the Australian cricket dressing room. Let me just add that that the opening batsmen have a special title. It's called the buff removers. In other words, they remove the shine off the ball. They're there just to do the job as the engine room of the side, which is 1, 2, and 3. That was called the engine room. And then from 4 down, they are all called the interior decorators. So the engine room kind of, you know, set up the innings. It did all the hard work. It's a thing that didn't have all the bells and whistles, but it's like the power plant of a Mahindra car. It's like, you know, that it's going to be solid because it's just, you know, it's got a sheer volume and weight, and it's important that sort of drivetrain itself is moving, you know, the whole vehicle forward. And then, you know, the interior decorators come in and they add the cruise controls, the indicators, the lovely interior designs, the washing, the beautiful panel that, you know, you see in front of your eyes, all the visual sort of effects, and both are very important. So JL and I were very much focused on making sure that our drive train, and I've got to add Ricky Ponting into this as well, our drive train did the work. It saw off conditions if it was green and seamy, or it saw off until lunchtime where you knew you were vulnerable. It took pride in those kind of, you know, holding that sort of group, that engine room together as long as it possibly could, so that it allowed what was pretty and finished and capable of driving a great result for the team, and that's bringing to life that sort of middle order for Australia, to give them opportunity to just flourish. So, you know, there was sort of real strong KPIs in all that direction for us, but I guess when we started feeling really comfortable within the side, either that's in state cricket or within the Australian team, naturally we came together in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But both of us at that point were extremely comfortable in our game, in ourselves and in our games and in each other. And so I guess that allowed for this progression of natural expansion of play.
Mm.
And Justin would often outscore me to 50. And then where I started to come into my own was through that sort of middle stages where I would start to elevate my scoring rate and risk, by the way, against spin and against medium paces, and I'd start to have a different gear. You know, but oftentimes he played at the ball a lot more than I did as well, because of his approach of going back and across meant that he was, you know, in line with the ball a lot more than me, and he loved to play through the covers. And naturally, as the majority of bowlers that we faced were right armers, which would go across the left-hand batsman, it would mean that I would leave a lot more balls. So we were the perfect combination, really, for he would get scoring rate going quickly, early, and then from there I would take it on and then the game would keep moving forward, you know, accordingly. Yeah, it was a very, very interesting sort of partnership when you look at it from an analysis point of view. Stuff that we didn't do when we were playing, but now sitting back thinking about it a bit more, you go, yeah, okay, that's interesting.
I want to talk about another topic and then wrap up the conversation. And, you know, you've been, I mean, Australia, they have been part of so many epic series, especially in the last 20 years, and you've been part of a few of those. Major one being, you know, the 2005 Ashes and obviously 2001 series in India. And I want to talk about that Indian series. You know, a lot of people talk about BVS Lakshman's output and Harbhajan Singh's output, but you scored more than 500 runs, averaging over 100. And Ricky Ponting, one of the all-time great batsmen, you couldn't buy a run in that series. Whereas you're piling it on, you know, what sort of preparation work went into that series? Because sort of from that series, your average is like 50, you average 58. Before that series, your average is 24. What went into that series and how did that transform you as a player?
Yeah, look, it was definitely a watermark series for me where it started from an international cricket point of view because it's you can cut stats off where you want. And I don't know them all, so I'm not really a stats-driven person. But, I mean, what was ringing in my ear was the fact that after seven test matches, I'd averaged 21. And I know that for a fact because Glenn McGrath used to come up to me all the time and say, mate, you're not that good. I think I've just about pipped you on the aggregate of runs, which was salt in my wounds for sure. But then I guess, you know, the West Indies series ahead of that Indian summer came along and I got some really significant runs that sort of broke the camel's back in a lot of ways in terms of arriving at Test match cricket. I got run out a few times in that series, but it made some massive progression. And so, you know, there was an overarching theme that it wouldn't matter whether I was playing in India, New Zealand, you know, or any of the other countries, I was going to arrive at a series at some point, and India just so happened to be in the unlucky zone of where that was at. But also, I think technically, I'd been working very hard behind the scenes for a decade on my ability to be able to score against turning bowlers and on turning tracks. And there was years of planning that went into that, right back to 93, where Bob Simpson had planted a seed about sweeping, as did Alan Border, to rotate strike. So there was a seed that came through there. That was growing through my experiences at county cricket, in particular at Northants, at that sort of 98, 99 period where I was captain of Northants. And I had, you know, two really quality spinners, Alec Brown and Graham Swan, and Monty Panesar as well. It was they were kids, and you know our wicket was a turning track because that was our natural edge. Our home tracks were turning, and that was, you know, to suit the team, but it also suited me as well as a side benefit of that, because I was able then to really hone and develop my technique through those 2 years of county cricket, you know, which wasn't that far away from, you know, the 2001 series where I was destined to arrive. And I think, you know, more than anything, look, this story has got a very deep and rich history for me personally, because it started as also way back in 95, 96, when I was begging the Australian selectors to take me away to the MRF Pace Academy, where they were holding a spin bowling clinic with Venkat and Bishan Bedi, and I didn't get picked in it, and I was, you know, curious to know why, because I was an emerging player and I wanted to go, and I was sort of putting my case forward and even said at the time, look, I'm going to be the person that's going to have the character to drive a good result for you in India. Mm-hmm. So that vision was very much in my mind. And even I'll never forget walking off the Chennai field and turning to one of my colleagues, Matthew Elliott, who was, you know, opening batsman and mm-hmm. I think playing a bit more for Australia at the time, and saying, Matthew, his nickname is Herbie, I'm going to get a test match 100 here one day. And he was like looking at me thinking, what's that got to do with anything? We're not even anywhere close to test match cricket. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then to think of that sort of statement and then, you know, how it proved to be incorrect, actually, because I got a test match 200 there.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, I look back at my very fond memories of playing for CSK and mm-hmm. the importance that stadium had, you know, for me personally and my growth and development, and to see all these lovely sort of different genres of cricket come to the sort of stage and be a part of that sort of inaugural series of IPL and mm-hmm. and even since, you know, commentating at the ground and having a really close connection with the people of Chennai. And, you know, things just are meant to be, aren't they? Sometimes you just got to give into the higher forces and just say, you know what, this is forever and I don't understand it, but, you know, so be it.
I was going to bring up that talk about the Pace Foundation, MRF Pace Foundation holding a spin bowling clinic. And I read that somewhere about you taking part in Bishan Bedi and Venkat Raghavan being there. What were the aspects that you were trying to absorb about, you know, spin bowling, facing spin bowling, that you would implement later on?
So, interestingly, I can't remember picking up a bat more than two or three times on that sort of 6 or 7 day trip. But what I did do is I sidled up next to those two very talented Indian spin bowlers and very different Indian spin bowlers as well, and trying to understand, you know, what flight meant strategically, trying to understand what a spin bowler was in their mindset trying to achieve by putting rotation on the ball and setting a certain field place. You know, those lessons I'd never been taught, because all I could look back on and see was three slips and two gullies, mm-hmm. you know, on fast bouncy conditions. So I didn't really understand, you know, the overall strategy of what a spin bowler was looking to achieve, both technically, you know, or from a strategic point of view. So, you know, they were just invaluable lessons. And look, the bowmanship as well, even if that's a word, but, you know, that ability for a crafty person of Bishan Bedi's, whose mind is as sharp as a tack, mm-hmm. His thought process around tossing the ball in the air, because when you really boil it down, there's no threat. There's no imminent threat. I mean, compared to Shoaib Akhtar is bowling 160 kilometre an hour thunderbolts where you're physically challenged and you've got the possibility of getting dangerously hurt, as opposed to someone that's coming in and bowling, you know, high 80s, early 90s, you go, you take that any day of the week, right? So that whole difference between the mental anxiety and the concern of being hurt, as opposed to with spin bowling, it's the mental fear. Yeah. It's the fear of failure. It's the fear of stepping out and being stumped. And so, you know, bridging those two gaps was an important part of that trip, and understanding that only through risking getting stumped, I mean, it's only going, as I said, 90K, that you start to confront your own fears in that space and you start to develop and learn strategies accordingly. It was a wonderful, I can't express to you just how and to your listeners just how important that time was, and an important introduction more than anything to India, which I'd never seen. You know, coming from a, like I'm looking out as I'm doing this interview now to my backyard, and I've got a pizza oven, I've got a herb garden, and there's the only thing that I can see is a crow on the trees. there's not one person in sight or sound of me here. And yet coming to, you know, Chapak Stadium, where you've got, you know, workers and you've got, you know, the crowds in and around the markets outside the streets and, you know, the beachfront location. I mean, that to me, it's like polar opposites to what I'm used to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it was a great introduction to the heart of India as well.
I want to ask you one last thing, which is, you know, you are an opening batsman in a fast bowler's body, very intimidating presence. I don't know whether, we talked about mental aspects of it. So the physical aspects of it, did you try to manifest that perhaps along the lines of what Steve Waugh would say as mental disintegration? Would you try to use that to your advantage, intimidate the bowler?
Well, the short answer is yes. The long sort of side of it is that it was a very natural thing for me because it had already been developed before I arrived at international cricket. In other words, you know, I went home to Kingaroy, where my hometown is, just over this week, and saw my parents who live on a, you know, 800 odd acre property, and on that property we actually live on the side of a volcano. It's red basalt soil. It's deeply rich soil, and it's extremely hilly. And I guess whilst cricket was, you know, I had a cricket wicket which my brother and I would roll every afternoon and mow, and it was a net on a 10-acre house block that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, the sports that I would love was hunting over these mountains, and I would climb these serious mountains every day of my life.
Mm.
You know, so physically, you know, I was very capable. I was swimming, and I love to swim, and it's something which is not a stress on my body to do. So I developed, you know, my body in a way that was, I guess, exploring all of these different sports. So by the time that I actually, you know, came to the high performance arena,
mm-hmm.
I was kind of a one-off in a lot of ways. I was as much an Iron Man as what I was a cricketer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, having surfed, having fished, you know, having hunted, you know, like having just this whole sporting diverse landscape, that it was a natural thing. In fact, the very first time I saw Justin Langer,
mm-hmm.
Which was way back now in early 1991,
mm-hmm.
he was in the middle and he came up to me and he thought that I was the groundsman. He actually asked me, this is not a word of a lie, he said, you know, what's this going to play like, mate? And, you know, what's the conditions like generally? And I said, man, I'm a player. you work it out for yourself, champ, you know. I don't think I said anything truthfully, actually. What happened was that I just said, oh, no, it looks pretty good, and we had a bit of a chat.
Mm.
But then, to his surprise, what he didn't realise that I was actually fielding bat pad for him the next day when he was opening the batting for WA. And I said, you thought I was a groundsman yesterday, didn't you? He said, yep.
All right.
So my physique was already developed. And,
yeah.
And I guess, you know, what I didn't mention before is that my brother Gary, he'd studied human movement study at Queensland University. And so, you know, it was a time when high performance in every sport, not just cricket, every sport, and Queensland was sort of the epicenter in terms of Australian development of players and playing groups, football and other codes for high performance. And so the studies to this day still are really cutting edge that come out of the Queensland University high performance culture in along, you know, what words like VO2 max, which no athlete had ever heard about, but all of a sudden there was a KPI connected to all of your physical attributes, of which I was probably 15, 20 years ahead of the pack because my brother, you know, was studying what that was looking like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so it was just a number of things when you look back at your career that were the perfect storm to kind of have me evolve to a state where I was ready to play.
All right. On that note, Matt, thank you so much for this enlightening chat.
That's in the air. Absolutely. This could be our Garvin's underneath it. Will he catch it?
Yeah, thanks, Bash. No problem at all, Matt.
Yes, he has. Garvin's got him in the deep. Having fumbled all night, he's taken the big one. It went wild in the air. He's got a good catch. Coach Talk.